It said that we're really cultivating, when we cultivate mindfulness, is the ability to not have any real change in the quality of our mind when we move from one posture to another. And every posture becomes an object or position for meditation. So we're practicing all the time. Why waste your time? So, does anybody have any questions about practice? Yeah.
Now, during metta meditation, if you're sending metta to somebody, do you have to have a very clear picture of who that person is? Because I have a person in my Medicaid whom I don't know all that well and haven't seen all that often, so it's kind of hard for me to kind of get a range to them.
Yeah, I would say that it's not necessary to have a clear, you know, picture or visualization of the person. It's simply enough to, you know, to bring them to mind in whatever way is possible for you. Yeah. And it's even said that in any kind of visualization practice, the quality of the visualization is secondary to the intention and the ability to just stay with some aspect of the image. Anything else? Any other kind of technical questions? I'll take that as a no. Decided to talk about there's a sutta called the Instruction to the Kalamas. How many of you know of this? Does anybody? Yeah. So it's basically one of the most interesting teachings of the Buddha, because what it does is it really not only gives permission, but it almost points us to the notion that we are to use our own discretion and our own experience as the primary way that we evaluate whether a teaching is good or not good, so that we have this ability in the Buddhist tradition to not simply take on some kind of set of beliefs just because someone told us that it was a good set of beliefs to take on. So that we go beyond simple belief and faith, and we then have ourselves and our discretion to bring to bear, to see whether or not what we're hearing from a teacher or reading in some way is in fact useful or not useful. So I'm going to read part of the sutta, summarize it a little bit, and then we'll open up for comments, questions, and create a dialogue. So this is taking place as the Buddha is passing through a part of the country called the Kosala country, and he comes to a community of people who are called the Kalamas. I don't know whether it's a tribe or a group of people in northern India at that time. And they say to him, they come to the Buddha and they say that, let me just get to the point. So these guys basically are saying that there are some monks and Brahmins, venerable sir, who visit our area. They expound and explain only their own doctrines, and the doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. Some other monks and Brahmins too, venerable sir, come to our area. They also expound and explain only their doctrines. The doctrines of others they despise, revile, and pull to pieces. There is doubt, there is uncertainty in us concerning them. Which of these reverend monks and Brahmins spoke the truth, and which falsehood? And the Buddha responds, it is proper for you to doubt, to be uncertain. Uncertainty has arisen in you about what is doubtful. Come, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, nor upon tradition, nor upon rumor, nor upon what is in the scripture, nor upon surmise, nor axiom, nor specious reasoning, nor upon bias towards a notion that has been pondered over and over, nor upon another's seeming ability, or upon the consideration that monk is our teacher, the lamas. When you yourselves know these things are bad, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill, abandon them. And he goes on to say that he asks them, does greed, does hate, and does delusion appear in a man for his benefit or harm? And of course they say, for his harm. Well, given to delusion, to hatred, to greed, and being overwhelmed and vanquished by the mentality of delusion, people are driven to take life, steal, commit adultery, tell lies. He prompts others to do likewise. Will that long for his harm and ill? Yes. Is this good or bad? It is bad, venerable sir. Blamable or not blamable? Blamable. Censured or praised by the wise? Censured. Undertaken and observed to do these things lead to harm and ill or not? Or how does it strike you? Undertaken and observed, these things lead to harm and ill. Thus it strikes us here. And he goes on to say that if these things lead to harm and ill, abandon them. What are the criterion for accepting effective teachings? Do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated hearing, etc., etc., etc. These things are good. These things are not blamable. These things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed. These things lead to benefit and happiness. Enter on and abide in them, if that's the case. And he goes on, he says, does the absence of greed, does the absence of hate, does the absence of delusion appear for benefit or not? And they, of course, agree that it is for benefit. Then he says, well, then enter on and abide in them. The disciple of the noble ones, Kalamas, who in this way is devoid of coveting, devoid of ill will, undiluted, clearly comprehending and mindful, dwells having pervaded with the thought of amity, one quarter, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above, below, and across he dwells, having pervaded because of the existence in it all living beings everywhere, the entire world, with great, exalted, boundless thought of amity that is free of hate and malice. And he goes on to say that loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity are the fruits of abiding in the positive aspects. And he talks about the four solaces. These disciples of the noble ones, who has such a hate-free mind, such malice-free mind, such an undefiled mind, and such a purified mind, is one by whom four solaces are found here and now. The first is that it is possible that at the dissolution of the body after death, I shall arise in the heavenly world, which is possessed of the state of bliss. This is the first solace. But suppose that there is no hereafter. There is no fault. Suppose there is no hereafter, there is no fruit, no result of deeds, done well or ill. Yet in this world, here and now, free from hatred, freed from malice, safe and sound and happy, I keep myself. This is the second solace found in him who is going to abide in the positive. Suppose evil deeds befall an evildoer. I, however, think of doing evil to no one. Then how can ill results affect me, who does no evil. This is the third solace. And the fourth, suppose evil results do befall an evil, do not befall an evildoer. Then I see myself purified in any case. This is the fourth solace. The disciple of the noble ones, Kalamas, who has such a hate-free mind, such a malice-free mind, such an undefiled mind, and such a purified mind, is one by whom, here and now, these four solaces are found. And they basically say, so it is, blessed one, so it is, sublime one. The disciple of the noble ones, venerable sir, who has such a hate-free mind, malice-free mind, undefiled mind, and purified mind, is one by whom here and now four solaces are found. And they basically repeat exactly what the Buddha has said to them, reminding themselves that even if there's no afterlife, even if karmic consequences don't befall them, following a positive path based on one's own decision as to whether or not something is positive or negative is going to pay off for them. So recapping this, basically the Buddha is saying, do not go upon what has been acquired by repeated teachings. Do not go upon what is acquired by tradition, nor rumor, nor what is written in a sutra, nor upon surmise or axiom or specious reasoning, biased towards a notion that has been pondered over, nor upon another's seeming ability, nor upon the consideration that this monk is our teacher. When you yourselves know these things are good, these things are not blamable, these things are praised by the wise, undertaken and observed, these things lead to benefit and happiness, enter on and abide on them. So basically in this teaching, the Buddha is encouraging free inquiry. The spirit of the sutta signifies that teaching is exempt from fanaticism, from bigotry, from dogmatism and intolerance, because basically in and of themselves, these things are in effect filled with greed, hatred, and delusion. So that he opens the teachings to a self-study. At the same time, we're kind of warned against the notion that it's not just left open completely to figuring out, this, that, or the other thing, without considering what is in the teachings. So it's basically saying, consider what has come down through the centuries as wisdom, but don't take it on face value. So, any comments? How does it feel to be, given the responsibility to make up your own mind about what's wisdom and what's not?
Well, you seem to be saying, match it to your own experience.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what he's saying, is that if it doesn't suit you, if it doesn't feel as if it's something that is right for you, then let it go. And how do you decide whether it's right for you or not? I mean, sometimes that can lead us astray because, it feels really good in the moment. The judgment is about whether it causes harm. So it's not just about, it feels really good, and that leads to some of the new agey kind of things. If it's good for me, it's got to be good. Feels all right, as opposed to if this really feels great, it's sensually pleasing, but it's causing harm to someone else. Or perhaps it's causing harm to me in the long run because it's leading me away from from some higher goal. then we can reject. What else?
More about the four solaces and how they relate to personal, personally, or how
you relate more personally? I think that from a personal point of view, the four solaces are basically saying the first one requires an acceptance or a belief in a future life. And he's saying basically if there's a future life and you do all these positive things, you're going to be born in a heaven realm. But what if there is no future life? Do we stop practicing? And it's a controversy. You know, there are significant Buddhist teachers and practitioners who basically say that we're not convinced that there's a future life. So now the other solaces are basically saying, even if there is no future life, even if there's no karmic consequences for the acts that evil people do, there's a payoff for me personally by ethical behavior. So that if I behave ethically, if I follow the precepts and so forth, then I'm going to feel better about myself. I'm going to personally have a clearer mind. I'm going to personally be in a situation that is likable for myself. So even if the evil deeds of people are not punished, it's me that's going to get this payoff from ethical behavior. And I think that's a very important teaching, because basically a lot of people condition their behavior on some kind of future gain. They condition their behavior on, how come if this guy did evil and he wasn't punished, I'm off the hook. Yeah? I can do whatever I please. Instead of that, we're kind of reminded that ethical behavior is about cultivating ourselves, cultivating our own mind and really bringing together the act and power that comes from meditation and the power that comes from wisdom into our daily life. So that's how I think it operates. Any other takes on that?
I just find it incredibly liberating, because I was raised in a tradition where there was just a ton of dogma thrown at you at all times. Mm-hmm. And even if the more scholarly aspects of that tradition said to you're free to inquire, but you were never free to actually disown the dogma. And yet this is saying to reject it. And I recall that, in my teens, I went completely nihilistic. But this is actually giving a non-nihilistic and yet non-theistic formula for a system of ethics that does not, where you are able to decide for yourself, but only after that's consideration. And it's quite different from what I thought was
Yeah. I think in general it's different than how most of us are brought up in religious teachings, including Buddhist teachings. I mean, people who are brought up in that tradition often are faced with the same kind of dogmatic approach. So it's not just the Judeo-Christian Islamic world that has that. It's just you name it. If there's a group of, a set of teachings around a figure or a group of people who have, who are venerated, there's a tendency towards belief that is unfounded, that is not founded on any, personal experience. So the Buddha, really is cutting the roots of that. Some people find it quite disturbing. Some people find, how many of you find it really liberating to know that, you're being, in effect, put in charge? And how many people like the idea of somebody else being in charge and, it's kind of makes life a little bit easier. I don't have to make so many decisions. Yeah? So it's there is a quality of you know, kind of an extra effort that has to be placed on one. It's a burden that is there. And this, you know, gets into the whole notion of right effort. The idea that we need to make an effort to do the work of ethical behavior, cultivating wisdom and meditative practice, so that we personally are walking the path. Say more about that.
The idea that we don't have to look outside ourselves for the answers gives us puts the responsibility in our center, but it doesn't necessarily say that whole idea of where it's coming from is coming from a favorite place.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's quite possible, and we know that the wisdom that is coming in the form of the Dharma and whatever, you know, form it comes from is not personal. It's, you know, another part of the teaching is, you know, the fact that ultimately we go beyond our personal identification with an ego. So if we're judging everything from this ego place, that's going to usually lead us astray, and if it doesn't lead us astray ethically, it'll get us stuck in the ego, and we're going to ultimately suffer for that. So we go beyond the notion of I'm deciding, and we recognize that we're letting the decision of what's right and not right appear. And whether you believe that it appears from an external place or an internal place, it's not the normal intellect. It's not the normal ego that's getting that, that's making that decision. It's not an intellectual decision. So we, you know, some would call it, you know, a voice from outside, some will call it intuition, but whatever you call it, it's something that's non-personal, it's non-individualized.
This reminds me of that saying,
mm-hmm.
One of the things I find intriguing is, depending on who does the translation, there's a totally different meaning on how this is translated in a whole different way. But having said that, like, one of the things that sticks in the back of my head is this aspect of right here, right now is important. You know, the what if, what could be, am I going to get reborn as a fish in the next life? That's a what it could have should have, and that doesn't connect to right here, right now. And that's the message that I'm seeing, is that in this moment, you can be with your feelings, with your thoughts, and with your actions, and exist.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the message of these four solaces, is basically that regardless of what happens next, it's right now that you are making this decision. Is your sense that this is the right thing to do for this in this moment? But I do want to balance this with with this other thing you started. You know, some teachers will stress one part and some will stress another. A very powerful teacher is basically saying that on the basis of a single passage quoted out of context, the Buddha has been made out to be a pragmatic empiricist who dismisses all doctrine and faith, and whose Dharma is simply a free thinker's kit to truth, which invites each one to accept and reject whatever he likes. Yeah, so we're not talking about that, and we're not talking about accept the Dharma without question, because it's the Dharma. So it's, you know, it's really that middle way. You know, it's recognize that the teachings are something that are, they're tried and true. They're like around for 2,500 years. And they have been tested over and over again, but also have been translated and commentarialized and, you know, interpreted by thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And if you read the commentaries and all of the various takes on Buddha, even just within the Theravadan tradition, there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty, a tremendous amount of lack of clarity, no definitive statements being made. So who do you believe? Yeah. And then you add in the Mahayanists and the, the Vajrayanists and yada, 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 and then you've got total chaos. Nobody knows. And those who know don't say, they say. So we have to know. We have to know for ourselves. So how does this this notion of ethical behavior strike you? There's a, there's one of the things that I notice as a teacher and talking to other teachers, we find that a lot of people are in it for the sizzle of meditation and concentration practice. That, I'm going to sit on my cushion, I'm going to close my eyes, and I'm going to go out. And I'm going to experience emptiness and clarity. How many of you are of that school of thought? Okay. And what about the rest? What are you into it for? Why are you here?
I don't know exactly what I need to do, but I know that by meditating, by doing other practices, I'm emotionally, physically more prepared to deal with the situations which I have to deal with
okay.
in life. And I'm capable of setting more sophisticated goals and intentions and following through with them with less effort as if I don't practice.
Okay. That's a good reason for being.
And similar to that, I come here for the meditation practice to build or cultivate this awareness that hopefully I'll be able to bring along into daily life more regularly. And I find already this slight change to be more aware.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's an egoistic, need of mine to sit on the cushion and avoid something or have some sort of experience. It could still turn around into having more insight into suffering and into the changing nature of the mind. So the ethics then come out of it because I don't want to cause suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to cause more suffering than is already.
Mm-hmm. How many of you ask yourself the question, why am I doing this? It's a kind of a strange thing to do when you think about it, right? See?
I was on a retreat up in Garrison, and we had a sharing circle. This isn't my statement, it's a great statement because it really made me think about my practice. And that was asked by one of the story of Oslo, what are you doing? And one gentleman said it beats the old thing. And I really, having now sat for a while and worked with this, and it is work. It's not always like a walk in the park. It's not always like, sometimes you feel guilty about doing it because you think, oh, I got other stuff I need to do for life. And this is kind of like frivolous. Why am I spending 45 minutes there's another place to go. And that's from doing this. That's not on my own. I think that, you know, it gives me a second to just step back from my existence and actually be instead of like do.
So again, how many of you have asked this question of yourself seriously and received some kind of answer? Not so many, yeah. I mean, if you don't really delve into that question, then you're just playing, yeah? But if you delve into that question and you get some good answers, like, you know, like really seeing these fruits, and then understanding the benefit of these fruits, not only in your life, but how your life affects other people, then you're doing something that's meaningful.
Yeah, I thought about the question many years ago in this practice, and the answer that I seem to have hasn't really changed much over the last quite a few years, so it seems to work for me, and it seems clear on it. I find a better reason, I'll switch, but it's to end all suffering for myself and all others, and to live a life and experience of joy, bliss, and love. And that's pretty much what the practice for me is aimed for. But you mentioned about ethical practice, and you got into the answer, why practice ethics? You did ask that, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah.
And I found that, and you also asked about, you know, who's in the paid practice, and I put my hand up for that, but I also have practice ethics. And the reason is, someone said, I don't know who it was, that if you want to have self-esteem, it's very simple, just do esteemable things. And I found that to be true. The practice of ethics, for me, it kind of puts my mind at ease, it puts it in a peaceful state so I can meditate with greater clarity and concentration because it's not so distracting. So it's like a potion to take to meditate better. And also then there's the other aspect of it. If you do things that are good, you're not looking behind your back, you're not worried about keeping your story straight, who you got to watch out for. It tends to simplify life. Not that I'm doing it for the expectation of any reward, other than feeling good about myself, and also you feel good about other people. It seems it's just a result of it. And the other thing with ethical practice is I'm never quite sure if it's a method or it's a result of a method. And it kind of flips back and forth from both sides for me.
Well, it's the teachings basically think of the Eightfold Path as being not so much a linear path where one thing leads to another, but rather an intertwined, it's like a rope. You create a rope out of a multiple set of intertwined strands. So ethical behavior and all of the elements of it are strands in that rope that both reinforce meditation and are reinforced by meditation, that both reinforce wisdom and are reinforced by wisdom. So it's not a clear causative relationship. If I use the ethical behavior as an object, if I use my behavior in general as an object of meditation, of an object of mindfulness, then I'm strengthening my mindfulness meditation by, in effect, making my behavior a meditative practice. And similarly, I'm allowing myself to be more discerning in my behavior if I'm mindful. It's very difficult to be, to make the decision as to whether one thing is right action or not right action without having the mindfulness that enables me to step back, as Pete was saying. So how do I cultivate that? I meditate. I create that capability in my mind to be able to retain mindfulness and be a little bit more concentrated, and therefore I can bring that to bear in my day-to-day activity. So you can see that those two things are working together. I'm day-to-day, I'm in effect meditating all the time, and I'm cultivating more and more of that power of mind, and in my meditation practice I'm cultivating that power of mind so that I can be more capable of doing it in the day-to-day. And then we bring wisdom in by recognizing that if everything is impermanent and there's no I and there's no, and dukkha is a fact of life, then I'm motivated to not create any kind of unnecessary ripples based on greed, hatred, and delusion. Right? Because I see that those things are emanating from a delusion in and of itself, and I'm no longer bound to that kind of reactive mind, and therefore my behavior is almost naturally going to be positive. So they all work kind of together. Subjective.
So in order to counterbalance that, the meditation is just, it's not a big deal to be able to meditate. All you're doing is stopping the mind from doing this all the time. And being able to say, you know, after 10 or 15 years of it, okay, so what? What is that really doing other than letting you from that space bring in what that chatter is keeping out? Really
just counterbalancing that utter flight, you know, it's the next step sort of in my opinion in evolution to the human machinery doesn't
house everything there is to, you know, it's just
it's
an old mechanism that we're stuck in that causes all the non-ethical
behavior. Yeah, it's interesting. There are different metaphors for it. So, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, it would be not so much that the mechanism is an old mechanism, or does that we don't contain the stuff that we really need to evolve, but that it's naturally part of us, and that it's clouded by the distractions and the conditioning that we have. So the conditioning is both physical, physiological, you know, the flight or flight response is physiologically embedded, but also we are. On top of that, we're conditioned over and over again to do some things that are really not that clever in the long run. So whether you look at it from the point of view of undoing the conditioning or somehow bringing something in from the outside that's going to balance it, in either case, we're talking about getting clearer and clearer through the use of our meditative practice, not because the meditative practice is making us clear, but because it gives us the opportunity to experience a clarity that is intrinsic. That's what the Buddha is saying, that the clarity of mind is something that is intrinsic to our nature. It doesn't have to be brought in from the outside. We just have to let it come out and recognize it. That's, you know, and it's a different take. I think it leads perhaps to the same ultimate place, but as long as we have this notion that there's something wrong with us, it's taking us away from the realization of what's right with us. We don't want to, you know, heap more negativity on ourselves by thinking of our package as being somehow seriously flawed. It's just right. We just have to find a way of allowing the just rightness of it to appear and become the predominant factor. Because once we start thinking that it's coming from the outside, what's out there? What is the outside? Then we start getting caught up into theistic thinking, and you know, is the being that is giving me this, or the set of beings, or the conditions, are they permanent or they're not permanent? We get caught up in a lot of theology, which, you know, gives you a headache in the end. Yeah. So it's just the way that you said that struck me as needing that kind of response.
It doesn't really matter so much what brought you to the path. Because it didn't blank out start because it was weak, he had bad headaches.
Mm-hmm.
In the end.
Yeah. I mean, most of us come to the path because we want to eliminate some, you know, relatively predominant pain and suffering. You know, it's like we're anxious, we're, you know, like we need to make clearer decisions because we've made some bad decisions, you know, whatever it is. That's usually what brings people to the path. And then as we come in contact with the teachings and we start having experiences, it opens us to the possibilities that are perhaps not evident when we're in this kind of narrow state of pain. So we move from a very I-centered desire for pleasure or avoidance of pain to something that says, well, that's not sufficient. We start to see with some degree of clarity that the cause of that set of headaches may easily be eliminated, but then what appears next is a more subtle pain, and a more subtle pain after that, and a more subtle pain after that, and then I start, you know, depending on who I am, I start to really practice, and my intention changes. But some people never change their intention. You know, they come for the headache relief, they get the headache relief, and they're satisfied, which is great too. So, yeah.
You just mentioned that people come here because of the pain and some people are satisfied by taking medication.
Yes.
Do you think that depends on the person who's ready for practice, or do you think it's just a certain amount of pain and who's the person that you have?
I think that it depends on whether a person is ready for different aspects of practice. It's, many people are not. And they'll come to meditate, to relieve some pain, some surface type of, some very deep pain. I mean, people have been using meditation as a means to relieve some very serious physical and psychological difficulties. But they're not ready to deal with the notion that they don't have a solid self. You know, they're not ready to deal with the idea of transcending the normal sense of what it means to be a human being. And other people are just, oh, really? This is. There's more to it than just having sex and eating and watching television and so forth. Yeah, but it's hard to say. I mean, this is a group of people who are obviously motivated to be on the path, but how many of you have friends, relatives, and so forth that are, that think you're totally crazy? Huh?
Maybe they're right.
And maybe they're right, exactly. Who knows? Maybe they're right. So we have to really, be clear about the fact that what we're into may be totally delusion also. You know, we're so good at making delusions of anything. we can just take this a wonderful thing like the, you know, the Buddha Dharma, and turn it into an ego building, you know, craziness that divides us from the rest of the world, makes it impossible for us to relate, or other people to relate to us. We can do that. It's easy. Yeah. But if we do it and we see ourselves doing it, which is hopefully what's happening as we get more practiced in our mindfulness and so forth, then we can kind of see that for what it is, let it go, and engage in a much different way.
And the aspect of just assuming you're on the journey and that you're getting something is good enough. And the speed or the quickness of direction is no big deal. But that's a tough one. Because I think everything's got to be instantaneous. Like early on, I was here to kind of the store play. But doubt of what is this the correct place to be, is this the correct thing to do, can destroy it.
Yeah, it's one of the five hindrances is doubt. But it's unskillful doubt. It's doubt that's not, there's a kind of doubt, which is basically what this teaching tonight is about, is that there's a reasonably good doubt, which is basically looking in and saying, is this teaching correct? Is this a true, is this truth? But then there's the doubt that comes in and says, well, I must be doing something wrong because I'm not immediately liberated and, all of the other kinds of things that come about. We recognize the hindrances in and of themselves are useful things. So if we see doubt, then we start to, think about, is that valid? Is it not valid? Am I using this as another escape? Is it being used to build my ego? Or is it something that is ultimately going to eliminate the unnecessary aspects of the ego and give me the ability to be just really calm and present? there are schools of thought that say that the ultimate of meditation is non-meditation. That if we are meditating, then we are doing something in order to get something. Now think about that from a Buddhist point of view. If you're doing something, then there's a you doing it. And if you're trying to get something, there's some degree of clinging going on. So how smart is that? And the other side is saying that's very smart, because if you didn't do anything, you would be stuck in, in some kind of sleepy, reactive realm and not have the clarity of mind. But at the same time, ultimately, the game is to find that place where you're just present, present, open to whatever is occurring in the moment. And then, in that space, there's no meditation anymore. There's just being present. And it's said that the mindfulness practice resolves itself into that. That as we become more and more mindful, We see the witness arising, and it's very solid, and it's us looking in at what we're doing, and then it starts to dissolve and become an integral part of our practice, but it's still there on a very subtle level, and then ultimately we become just present, and the mindfulness is there. It's just another aspect of mind that is normal. That's, you know, kind of what we're really seeking, I think, in our practice.
But what I find at times that I like is with that mindfulness, when the, you know, greed, hatred, delusion, hindrances are able to be cut through, even temporarily, the other qualities emerge of boundless kindness, mm-hmm. that's sustainable.
You know, yes.
Equanimity. You know, so it makes me think of this controversy about, you know, is it a sort of enclosed one-person practice, self-indulgent practice versus a relational practice? And I think it's relational at best.
I think, yeah.
Because you do, you know, you do start to have regard for people around you. And
yeah,
it
matters
how you treat people.
Yeah.
And there's a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, I think that's very clear. I mean, when you look at the teachings basically say that the four Brahmaviharas, of the four of them, three of them are totally about interrelationship. You know, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy. That's all about opening to the nature that we have, which is an interpersonal nature. It's not just about me. If we keep it just about me and, you know, everything is focused on that, then we're missing the point. And even equanimity is, you know, is something that once we open to equanimity, there's no more differentiation in true equanimity. So very much, I think it's a relational process.
What exactly is the difference between loving kindness and compassion?
I don't know if anybody really knows, but my take on that, my understanding of it, is that compassion deals with the ability to feel the pain and suffering and experience of others. Whereas loving kindness is, and not only the pain and suffering of others, but all of the feelings of others. That compassion enables me to know the experience of others because it's my experience. And through that, I have now this ability to just open and, you know, if I see someone starving or someone crying or someone in pain, I feel that as if it is mine. Because I've lost the differentiation and it is mine. That's how I understand compassion. And I just want to answer the part about loving kindness. And then loving kindness is about expressing some positive hope or desire for the benefit of myself and others. So that's how I understand the difference.
I guess I want to add a pigeon right here.
Say again?
I guess I want a pigeon right here.
Yeah, yeah.
For me, compassion is almost synonymous with empathy, and my own emotional experience of empathy is very warm, almost hot experience, where I'm trying to feel the other person's emotion. There's different levels that you train yourself into, like with that on a cognitive level, and then you can move it down. And so it's literally feeling with that person, you feel their story, and then you imagine yourself experiencing it, like visually in your head, you imagine that situation as becoming your story, and then you imagine yourself doing those things, feeling those things. Eventually,
and that.
And then the other half of loving kindness, that to me is a more peaceful, serene. I would say that's more like compassion in other sense, that you love that person in kind of this new, open kind of way, and that hope that was given.
Yeah, this is a psychological interpretation. It comes from a school of thought that doesn't include transcendence. So in the Buddhist teachings, there's a very distinct difference between empathy and compassion. Empathy implies two separate entities, two beings. And while we don't put in, there's no pejorative about that, it's a different quality. In order to empathize, I have the sense of there's me, there's this other person, and I somehow have to get into their head. In the in the Brahma Viharas, the notion of compassion is that there's been a dissolving. There's no longer multiple entities. There's a sense of completeness that encompasses all beings, and therefore I don't have to work at empathy. The empathy is naturally, I'm beyond empathy and I'm into compassion. And the distinction is empathy is one person cultivating a set of feelings and emotions that simulates what another is feeling and does that very well and allows for a more deep understanding, but still there's that separation. Compassion, very different. Compassion, no separation, no tendency for the quality of hierarchy that often comes into play when empathy is present. I'm empathizing. This person is my client or patient. This person perhaps doesn't have the power to empathize with me, but I can empathize with them. I can get more close to them and therefore help them. Nothing wrong with that, but note the difference between that and the Buddhist quality of compassion. Very, very distinct. Huh? Well, it's difficult to grasp without buying into this notion of the emptiness of oneself. It requires, you know, and it's not a, you know, it conceptually, the two things seem quite alike. But when we kind of intuit it, when we really sit back and through meditative practice, get a sense of what it means to really lose oneself and really being in relationship with another in a way that has no boundaries, no eyes, then we can start to experience compassion. Now, that compassion in the Buddhist sense, it's called the Brahma Vihara. It's a realm of gods. You know, it's a god realm. So when we talk about that level, we can talk about it sometimes and we can get tastes of it in our practice, but until we reach a level of attainment of, you know, like an arhant, we don't experience compassion all the time. But we can get tastes of it and we can know the difference between compassion and empathy. Yes.
And she's talking about a relative reality.
Yes.
That you have to go back to reality, and you understand absolute reality.
Yes.
Is beyond, and then we bring it back into relative reality.
Yes.
So it operates in relative reality.
Yes. And then it's said that once compassion is cultivated, it operates in relative reality as well as in the absolute. That it's not something that is only in the absolute, that compassion can operate. And, you know, and we see examples of it in, you know, people like the Dalai Lama, who is not empathizing any longer. He's reached a certain level of experience, at least we think, that allows him to operate with true compassion as opposed to empathy. So, you know, again, it's in that realm of the absolute and bringing the absolute into the relative and letting them kind of mix with one another. But I think we'll have to call it an evening. It's getting to that time. I want to make a couple of announcements and then we'll end with a metta meditation. So the announcements, weekly announcements. How cleverly programmed this whole thing is. There's the week of January 16th to 22nd, the study of the four foundations of mindfulness. We're starting a four-part program that's going to be four full days of practice and discussion and teachings. The first day is January 22nd That's this Sunday, and I'm going to be leading that. It's one of the four foundations. The four foundations of mindfulness are basically the Satipatthana Sutta is a study of all of the basic elements of mindfulness meditation and the four basic objects, the body, feelings, thoughts, and dhammas or conceptual elements are going to be looked at each individually. So that's happening. Are you subscribed to our weekly emails or monthly newsletter? Do you know what our question of the month is? If not, you can subscribe. You can go to the website and find out. What is your intention in coming to New York Insight? You may remember the first time you visited. You may consider this while rushing from the office to make a Tuesday night sitting while greeting other Sangha members after a class or reaching for the Dana box, which reminds us that the center thrives on Dana or generosity. So there's no fee for tonight, and the teachers don't get fees, and we need to keep the center running. And the way that the center keeps running is that you guys donate money. So we're seeking your donations. Become a member of New York Insight if the teachings here and the community is something that you relish and value. Become a member. And there's benefits of event passes and so forth. And you can become a member for as little as $10 a month. This is a full set of the teachings for the month of January, so that's going to be outside, so you can take part in whatever teachings you would like to. So let's end the evening with a very short but extremely pithy metta meditation. So find that comfortable, erect posture. Relax into it. Open your heart. Come in touch with that space of love and kindness. And bringing to mind yourself, wish for yourself, may I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be free from suffering. May I be happy. May I be healthy. May I be free from suffering. And bring to mind those who you love, those who you have neutral feelings about, those who you dislike. Bring to mind people in all conditions, male, female, healthy, infirm, rich or poor. Bring to mind all beings throughout the universe, regardless of their condition, and for all, wish may they be happy, may they be healthy, may they be free from suffering, may they be happy, may they be healthy, may they be free from suffering, may they be happy, may they be healthy, may they be free from suffering. Take this practice of loving kindness and bring it into your daily life as you're walking down the street, as you're in conversation with others, in your relationships of all sorts, Just let thoughts of loving kindness invade your mind. Let them emanate from you as a radio waves might come from a tower. Fill the world with loving kindness.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.